Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are in Luke 23. While you are turning there, you know, I wrote the other day on the blog that I was working on a new audio offering, and I got three emails like right in a row that afternoon. Well, what is it? So here's what I've done. Over the course of the last several years, you know, I've written a few books, and they're all in PDF form on our website. The three finished books are By Grace Alone and A Guide to New Covenant Giving and Is the Church Israel. If you're listening to me right now on sermon audio, go to salvationbygrace.org and you can find those books. But I've had people, every so often people will write and ask if those books are in printed form, because it's easier to sit down and read a manuscript copy of a book rather than sit on the internet and read a PDF of a book. So I started thinking, well, how else can I make it even easier for people? Because that's really my job, make things even easier for people. And I thought, well, what if I were to read my books out loud? Would that be helpful? Oh, Carol's in the front row already going, yeah, okay. So I thought, well, that would be an interesting experiment. After all, what do I do for a living? I'm an audio engineer, and I have a studio in my house, and I record people talking all day. And I've recorded lots of audiobooks through the years, so I thought perhaps I could make an audiobook of me reading my book. So over the course of the last month, that's what I've done. So I had to pick a book to start with, and there it is, A Guide to New Covenant Giving, replete with little music breaks and the occasional sound effect, fun to listen to. I've made it so easy now to listen to my books. Now, if you want it in CD form, where you can listen to it on a CD, it's 4 hours and 18 minutes long. And so it takes five CDs because of the way the chapters break down. However, if you want it in MP3 form, it's a single CD. Much, much easier. And I talked to Jeff yesterday about making a place on the website where we could put the eight chapter files up there on the listen link. Because that really is the easiest way for us to distribute stuff, is to just put it on our website, and then whoever wants it just downloads it. So, A Guide to New Covenant Giving audiobook, the first GCA audiobook. If this is something people like, if there proves to be enough of an audience for it, then I will move on to the next one. I'll probably do By Grace Alone next. So these are here for anyone who wants them. If you're listening over the internet and you want these, you just write to us, GCA, Post Office Box 1707, Smyrna, Tennessee, 37167. I'm saying that for all the folks on sermon audio, and we'll send it to you. Typically, we charge $5 for an MP3 CD. That does two things. That covers our costs, and it keeps people from just ordering CDs to use as coasters. But for $10, you can have any three. If you want the audio version, the CD audio version that is five CDs, you know, send us $10. Send us something to cover the cost and we'll send it to you. And hopefully this week we'll get it up on the website. Yeah? What we do is we have a gigabyte of space on our website. And we're constantly, every month, like pressing the edges of that because of the amount of audio material we keep on our website. So whenever we put something new up there, we have to clear something else off. And this week we put up a new Romans message on top of the other two weekly messages. So we just keep cranking out material on our site. So we'll have to find a couple of messages we can drop to make room for these. And we'll put a link there and put the book up for anybody who wants it. Okay? All right, we're in Luke 23. We had been talking about Herod the Great. Then last week we talked about Herod Antipas, his son. Talked about the fact that three of his sons, Philip and Archelaus and Antipas, became tetrarchs. Actually, Archelaus became an ethnarch over that whole region, that whole area. And we're going to start in Luke 23:6 to talk about Jesus going in front of Herod. But to kind of continue the historical perspective of it, Archelaus had problems with Rome, and he was not the political animal that his father and brother were. And so by 23 AD, Archelaus had been deposed, and so he didn't have the same power in the area of Judea that he once had. And Rome, rather than give any extra power to another foreign leader, usually they would send governors throughout all the different Roman provinces, and the governor would oversee that area on behalf of the Caesar. And typically they'd stay there a year, 2 years, and then move again, which was sort of Rome's way of keeping anybody from amassing too much local power or authority to themselves. They just kept kind of shuffling people around. Well, one of the rarities in that system was a guy named Pontius Pilate, who was sent as governor over that region of Judea. He was there 10 years, AD 26 to AD 36. During the time that he was ruling in that area, he tried to curry a certain amount of favor with the locals there. But he also did a lot of silly things, like at one point he decided that he would put Roman shields with pictures of the emperor in the front of the temple. And so there was a mass migration of protesters that all went to Caesarea, where he was. And he made them wait 5 days. He wouldn't even talk to them for 5 days, thinking he could just wait them out. And they'd get hungry, and they'd get tired, and they'd get thirsty, and they'd leave. And finally, after 5 days, when they wouldn't leave, he sat in his high pontifical chair and said, you either leave this whole issue alone, or I'll start chopping off heads. And so the story goes, they all bared their necks and laid down in front of him and basically said, start cutting. And he, understanding that he couldn't possibly explain to Rome why it is that he went around hacking off the heads of the people he was ruling over, he recanted. And they won through peaceful resistance, and he pulled all those symbols and emblems out of the temple. So he had this sort of tenuous relationship. He tried to be friendly with them. So one of the things that he did every year to try to curry favor, make peace with the people in Judea that he was ruling over, was that at the feast, like Passover, he would, number one, go to Jerusalem to make sure there was peace, keep the peace. You've got every Jew that can travel from all the various regions, even outside Judea, the diaspora, those had been dispersed all over the Middle East. Anyone that could travel, that could make the trip, was required 3 times a year to appear in Jerusalem before the Lord. The 3 Old Testament feasts were a requirement. And so you've got Jewish people from all over the region with all sorts of different ethnic backgrounds, and even, as you know, Day of Pentecost, a lot of different languages, different politics, and they all descend on Jerusalem. And so it was incumbent on him, Pilate, to make sure that he was in Jerusalem during that period. But then, in order to not appear that he was just there with a heavy thumb over them, it was his custom to give them back one of the Roman captives, one of the Roman prisoners, somebody who during the course of that year Rome had imprisoned. They would give them back to the Jews as a sign of good faith, as a sign of good favor. And that's going to come up this morning as he goes before Pilate, and Pilate decides that one of the ways he's going to try to keep his hands clean of this potentially very messy Jewish religious problem is to try to hand Jesus back to the people. And you know how that goes. They desire Barabbas instead. Do me a favor. Somebody look up. You can all look up if you'd like. I think it's Acts 3:13. You know what? Let's all go there. I know I told you to go to Luke. Let's start at Acts 3:13 because you kind of have to see Pilate through the eyes of what Peter says about him here in the book of Acts. There was a lame man that was begging for alms by the gate that was called Beautiful. And Peter and John healed the lame man. They saw the lame man there, and they stopped and healed him, starting at like verse 11. And as the lame man which was healed beheld Peter and John, all the people ran together unto them in the porch that is called Solomon's porch. And they were greatly wondering, and when Peter saw it, he answered unto the people, saying, you men of Israel, why do you marvel at this? Or why do you look so earnestly on us as though by our own power or holiness we had made this man to walk? Look at verse 13. The God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, the God of our fathers, has glorified his son Jesus, whom you delivered up and denied him in the presence of Pilate. Look at that line, when Pilate was determined to let him go. So you have to read Pilate through Peter's comments here. Peter is a first-hand witness, Peter who watched the whole proceedings. His summation of Pilate's political position was that Pilate was trying to let Jesus go. He was trying to avoid the potential political mess of getting involved in killing someone who hadn't really broken a Roman law. The only thing he had done was break some Jewish religious laws, which Pilate didn't want to have to mess with. Yes, sir?
Romans were also really driven by superstition. A lot of our common black cat kind of things come from their culture.
Right.
And when Pilate's wife had the dream portent to not harm Christ,
right,
this would have been a very ominous sign for any kind of Roman to not be involved with this.
Right. Yeah, the superstitions run rampant, as we're going to see here. I'm back in Luke. Luke 23:6. When Pilate heard that Jesus was a Galilean, when he heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem at the time. Why would Herod be at Jerusalem at the time?
Passover,
it's the feast, right. So Herod's going to go there because most of his subjects are going there. And even though he's a Idumean, he's going to go try to look like the leader of the Jews. He often pretended to be Jewish. And so he would show up there. So you've got these two leading political powers in the area at the time. You've got both Herod and Pilate at Jerusalem, and you've got this great throng, this pile of people, and they're all from different areas, and you've got different languages, and you've got different politics going on. So there's a potential powder keg boiling here right under the surface. And when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad. Doesn't that seem interesting? Now that's why I read all the stuff last week about him after he had killed John the Baptist. He began to hear about Jesus' miracles, and the first thing he thought was that it was John the Baptist raised from the dead. First thought for him was, I've gone and killed a prophet, and he's raised from the dead. That would be frightening. And when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was desirous to see him for a long time, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. Isn't that the natural fleshly thing? Herod says, okay, so there's this guy running around my domain, my jurisdiction, my area, who's from Galilee, and the stories about him are that he heals sick people and blind people can see and lame people are walking. He raised a dead guy, for heaven's sake. I want to see him walk on water. I want to see him do something that will convince me. I think Herod really wanted to be convinced. I think Herod had been anticipating. He was glad. He was looking forward to it. Finally, I get to meet this Jesus guy. And I think he thought that with all his political power, especially with Pilate sending him straight to him, he's thinking, boy, I am politically connected at this point. I can demand this guy to do a miracle for me. He wants Jesus to prove it. Put Jesus on trial. Now, do you remember Jesus going into the wilderness? And there were three temptations that he had to endure that had to do with the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh and the pride of life. And one of those was that he was to throw himself off a high pinnacle, took him up on the high pinnacle of the temple and said, throw yourself off. Satan said that to Jesus, trying to tempt Jesus, and said, because it's written that he will give his angels charge over you to bear you up, lest you would dash your foot against a rock. Do it. Just fling yourself off and let's see if the angels come and catch you or not. Because it's written in the Word, Satan quoting the Word. Satan's not afraid to quote the Word. Even quoting it to the Word, which I find remarkably bold. And as I've often said, if he's not afraid to quote the Word to Jesus, he's not afraid to quote it to you. But he'll quote it out of context, misuse it the way he did. Do you remember what Jesus' response to him was?
Don't tempt God.
He said, it is also written, yeah, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. What does that mean? That means if you say things like, I believe in the predestinary will of God and I can't die a minute before God wants me to die, so I'll throw myself in front of a bus to test the theory.
That might be your time.
That might be your time. Bam. God goes, I knew you'd do that. Yeah, you don't tempt the Lord. You don't say, well, it's written in the Word, and therefore, since it's written in the Word, I can put these things to the test. Like Paul had to deal with that when he said, should we sin all the more that grace may abound? Knowing that where sin much abounded, grace did much more abound. He said, well, then, should we sin all the more that grace may abound? He said, no, God forbid. That would be to tempt God to say, well, I know I'm forgiven, and it's all under the blood, and I'm forgiven for everything I do, so that gives me a license to do whatever I want to do. It's free reign now. That's to tempt God. That's the natural human proclivity, to get away with as much as you can get away with. Figure out where the line is and just step over that line. That's the natural human fleshly proclivity to want to see a miracle. Listen, if you knew, I mean knew, if you knew that up the street at the Methodist Church right up here, there was a guy right now raising a guy from the dead, how much more of what I'm talking about are you going to listen to?
Zero.
You're flying out the door. You're not even getting in your cars. You're jogging, forget it, dead run up to the Methodist Church because you want to see somebody raised from the dead. If you had somebody run through the door right now and say, I'm telling you, there's a guy at the Methodist Church right now healing every known disease. How long are you sitting here? He's out of here. You're gone. Everybody wants to see a miracle. Why do you think people put up with? You know the rest of that sentence, don't you? Okay, fill in the blank. Any number of people who can come fill the downtown arena and promise them miracles. Even though their teaching is completely off the wall, even though you'll hear no solid biblical exegesis or exposition of Scripture, even though they will make up all sorts of bizarre Gnostic ideas that can't be supported anywhere in the Bible, nevertheless, when they show up, they can absolutely pack the downtown arena. Why? Because people want to see a miracle. They really want to see a miracle. They'll show up if you can just do a miracle. What did Jesus say about a generation that required a miracle to believe? Yeah, no good words there. A wicked and adulterous generation requires a sign to believe. It seems to be the generation we're living in, though. Boy, they can't wait to see a miracle. Well, they will tolerate Benny Hinn's preaching. There, I named a name. They will tolerate him if he can pull out something that even vaguely resembles a miracle. Well, that was Herod. He said, you know, I've been waiting to see Jesus. Show me something. Amazingly, though, Jesus, and you're going to see this throughout the rest of this whole narrative between here and the cross, Jesus has all these opportunities where all he has to do is make nice with the person he's talking to. All he has to do is bend a little, and they'll let him go. They'll let him off. We already read Pilate wants him off. Jesus does nothing in his own defense. He does like Isaiah said. Isaiah said, like a sheep is dumb before his shearers, he answered not a word, predicting that when Jesus stood before these people, he would not defend himself. Now, why didn't Jesus defend himself to these people? He had a date with the cross. He had to go get on that cross. He had to be on there. He said, no man takes my life from me. I have the power to lay my life down, and I have the power to take it up again. He's going to tell Pilate in a few minutes. When Pilate says, I have authority over you. I have the ability to give you back your life or kill you. He's going to say, you don't have any power over me that isn't given to you from above. Complete control here. Christ is in complete control of everything that's happening. And because he is God incarnate, with him, words are things. Since he had already said to Peter, don't you know that my Father would send legions of angels to come and fight for me if I wanted to fight? Now's not the time to fight. Now is the time for him to lay down his life and redeem his people. There's a time to fight coming. There's a time to fight with Christ in a two-edged sword. There's a time to fight when Christ is going to take vengeance on his enemies. But it wasn't then. He came then to redeem his people. So he didn't speak a word because anything he spoke would happen. And he didn't come to free himself. He came to lay himself down. So when Herod saw Jesus, verse 8, he was exceedingly glad, for he was desirous to see him for a long season, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have some miracle done by him. He then questioned with him in many words, But Jesus answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes stood and vehemently accused him. So when he was sent to Herod, the whole mass of guys who were accusing him went with him to Herod. Herod asks him questions and questions and questions, and Jesus refuses to say anything in response. I think also the reason he did that, by the way, is that had Jesus responded to Herod, it would have been a way of Jesus saying that he recognized Herod's kingship. In Jesus' economy, there's only one king. There's one Lord, there's one God, and he's the only one who can demand answers of Jesus. Nobody else could demand Jesus to do anything or demand answers of Jesus. And had Jesus responded, that would have been a way of saying tacitly that Herod actually had some authority. Herod had no authority. So the chief priests and the scribes stood and vehemently accused him, and Herod, with his men of war, set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him again to Pilate. In other words, they decided they would make fun of him. Oh, you're the king of the Jews, are you? Well, how about we put the king of the Jews robe on you and we'll send you back to Pilate, a pathetic figure with a robe on. So what did Herod ultimately do? Nothing. He got none of his questions answered. He didn't adjudicate. He didn't sentence him. All he did was mock him and send him back to Pilate because ultimately Herod had no power. He had no ability to actually carry out his will, so he has to send him back to Pilate. Now look at verse 12. I find this fascinating. And the same day, Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for before they had been enemies between themselves. Isn't that remarkable? These two very powerful men who were both vying for power under Rome and are constantly having to position themselves to maintain their power, so they were always competing for power in the same region over the same people. And that day they became friends over their hatred of Christ. That's what made them friends. Before that, when it was politics, when it was Rome, when it was power, when it was control, enemies fighting each other. But what was the one thing they could agree on? We both hate Christ. That's human flesh. So verse 13, Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people, said unto them, "You have brought this man to me as one that perverts the people. And behold, I have examined him before you and have found no fault in this man touching those things whereof you accuse him. No, nor yet Herod. For I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him. I will therefore chastise him and release him." So that was Herod's first adjudication. I've examined him. Herod has examined him. I find him to be guiltless before Roman law. He hasn't done anything. There's no insurrection, no sedition. He hasn't done anything that would be worthy of death here. So I sent him to the king who is a Jewish king who would have understood your rules and your laws and all the things that you say he broke. And he couldn't find anything. So in order to put him back out on the streets, this was also fairly common Roman practice. If you were brought up on charges, and there were people there charging you, especially if there was a group of people charging you, a way of getting you to kind of stop whatever the behavior was that had caused these people to bring you in the first place, they would punish you and then put you back out on the street. And so that was his idea. I will scourge him, and then I will send him back out and free him. I'm going to release him. Which was not satisfying for these folks. Now, that being said, we've got to talk about theology for a moment. Pilate's scourging of Jesus, 39 lashes, was Pilate's scourging of Jesus any sort of recompense for sin? I'm watching the head shake. Okay. I figure if you all shake your head together, the noise will carry it. But no, it actually wasn't. There was no recompense for sin in the scourging. How many of you saw the Mel Gibson movie, The Passion of the Christ? I was taken to it, dragged to it, by someone who said, "I want to be able to be the first one to see your reaction."
Oh, dear.
It's true. Paid my way, picked me up, everything. Sat me down in a seat. Watch this. Repugnant piece of tripe. I'm sorry. Did I offer an opinion there? The Passion of the Christ was not based on the Gospels, despite the masterful way in which Mel Gibson managed to get the TBN evangelical groups to rally behind his movie. It was based on a Catholic seer. In fact, I have some of her books at home right now that I'm looking at. And that's why you see imagery in the movie that isn't anywhere in the Bible, because it was in her book. And what he was making was a movie of her book, not of the Gospels. Very Catholic, which is why there was so much Catholic imagery in it. So, one of the things that that movie really emphasized, the central theme of that movie, and one of the most controversial aspects of the movie, was the graphic nature of the beating that Jesus took. I mean, it was the 15-minute center portion of the film, because standard Catholic dogma is that the beating he took at the hand of the Romans, who were portrayed in the movie as being like one IQ level above simians, apish men who just gloried in shredding skin off people. But they wanted to really raise the emphasis on the beating, because it was the beating in his body that he took at the hands of the Romans that is the Catholic notion of where the payment for sin took place. That he endured that physical beating in his body, because it is that continuation of his body that is sacrificed at every Mass. Every time they hold Mass and they take the round wafer in the shape of the sun with the mark of Tammuz on it and say Hocus Corpus Meus over it, they believe that it becomes the physical body. And so that body has to continue being sacrificed and sacrificed and sacrificed. Which is why when you go into a Catholic church, you don't just see an empty cross. You see a crucifix. You see a body still on that cross, because that body has to continue being sacrificed and sacrificed. And it is the physical sacrifice of that body that is paying for your sin. Biblically, your sin was paid for when the wrath of God was poured out on Christ at Calvary. That's where the payment for sin took place. If simply, and I use the word simply in quotation marks here, if simply enduring 39 lashes at the hands of the Romans was the worst beating anyone ever took in history, and therefore we should empathize with Jesus' beating above all torture that all men ever endured, which was the theme of that movie, then what about the fact that Paul writes that on 5 occasions he was beaten with 39 lashes? Wasn't Paul's physical beatings and suffering, if you just do the math, didn't he actually take more beatings than Jesus did? See, the scourging, my point here is, the scourging was not a redemptive necessity. The scourging was part of the mockery that men made of Christ. The same way that nails being driven through his hands was part of the mockery of men of Christ. The same way that spitting on him, ripping out his beard, they blindfolded him and punched him in the face, and then mocked him and said, "Now prophesy, who hit you?" By the way, do you think he knew?
Sure.
Sure, of course he knew who hit him. It's going to be a sad day when the man who hit him shows up in front of the throne. He goes, okay, I'm going to answer your question now. You're the one that hit me. That's going to be a rough day. Now, all of the mockery that men did was all leading up to the redemptive moment. It was all part of the package, but there was no redemptive value to the scourging. Do you understand that? There was no redemptive value to the nails going through his hands and his feet. The redemptive value came when God himself poured out the wrath that was due you and I. Because you don't owe anything to Rome. And so Rome taking out their wrath on Jesus isn't really a substitutionary work. Do you understand what I mean? You owe nothing to Rome. There are a lot of people who will tell you that Jesus went to hell for the 3 days, belly of the earth. We can get into that theology later. I don't want to bog down on it here. But for the 3 days that he was in the grave, there is a theology out there that says that he went to Satan to pay a debt to Satan that we owed. We didn't owe a debt to Satan. We owed a debt to God. We didn't offend Satan. We offended God. We didn't sin against Satan. We sinned in cooperation with Satan. We didn't know Satan anything. Satan was on our side in the whole thing. God is the person, God is the master, the king, the Lord, who we are all sinning against, and that's who is owed, and that's who poured out wrath. That's who poured out punishment that had actual redemptive value. So you've got to get that straight, or you'll get caught in the Catholic notion that the beating itself had some redemptive value. What were you going to say?
Part of the confusion comes from by his stripes we're healed.
And I agree. I said it's all part of the package. My question would be this. If he only took the beating, would that have been enough to save you?
No.
Did redemption happen in the beating?
No.
No. Even if they had beat him and put him on the cross, but God didn't pour out wrath on him in your place in a substitutionary way, would that have been enough? No. So I think Isaiah was predicting the type of death he would die. Isaiah has a lot to say there about that the Father would look on him and be pleased. The Father was pleased to bruise him in our place. Isaiah 53 is what you're talking about, right? Well, let's just go look at it. Let's just solve this. Isaiah 53. Who has believed our report, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of the dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness. And when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. Who did the afflicting in that verse, and the strickening and the smiting? Who's the actor in that verse? God is, right. So in Isaiah's theology, it is God doing the smiting and the striking and all that. Now, we read it last week out of the book of Acts. Everything that the Jews, that the Gentiles, that Herod, that Pilate did was all what God had predetermined to be done. Right? So it's still the hand of God that is responsible for everything that was done. But according to Isaiah, that first he would be despised of men. And so that all happened. The spitting, the beating, the plucking out the beard, all of that was part of the humiliation that he went through at the hands of men. But from a redemptive standpoint, redemption didn't happen until God struck him, smote him, afflicted him, and he was wounded for our transgressions. And he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. It's still God that's the actor there. Right?
Peter quotes Isaiah 53 there in 1 Peter by saying his wounds you were healed, and specifically says, and he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross.
Yeah.
That we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you were healed.
Right.
Wait,
exactly. And maybe I can make this more specific by saying exactly what Jeff just read Peter saying. The focus of our theology has always got to be the cross is the place where redemption took place. It didn't happen in the stuff that was leading up to it. The Catholics would like you to believe that and have created a theology and a dogma around that so that they can keep his body as the sacrificial element that just continues to be sacrificed, and that it is the physical sacrifice of that body, starting at the beatings and continuing in the Mass, that redeems. But the biblical theology is redemption happened. Redemption actually took place. Satisfaction was accomplished. God did pour out his wrath for our cumulative sin, and so by his stripes, we are healed. But that, I think the word stripes there means more than just getting beat across the back. The language Isaiah uses is, he was stricken, he was smitten, he was beaten, by his stripes were healed. But it's all God that's the actor in all that. So the satisfaction that was accomplished was the satisfaction owed to God and God only. And human beings taking out their satisfaction on Christ was only a sign of their depravity and their wickedness. But there was no redemption in that. My point being, any more than there was redemption in the five beatings Paul took, right? If redemption is accomplished in the multitude of beatings, let's worship Paul. He took five beatings.
Many were crucified.
Peter was crucified. Did that do anything for anybody? Andrew was crucified. Did that do anything for anybody? No. It had to be the Son of God being stricken and smitten for our offenses. And you see the substitution there when it says that all our iniquities were laid on him. And then, as Peter's theology says, it was at the cross that satisfaction and redemption took place. So perhaps I've confused the issue by wandering into it, but I want us to focus on the single sacrificial work of Christ at the cross, satisfying God. Everything else was just building up to that. Yes, Rick?
Yeah, I was wondering, I was trying to remember, and I have to go back and check because I can't remember, but maybe you can, in Reformed theology's description of Christ's active and passive obedience. Mm-hmm. What's usually included in their understanding and description of his passive obedience? Is it the cumulative sufferings or strictly only the sufferings on the cross? Do you remember? I can't recall myself.
The way I've understood active and passive obedience has to do with his active obedience to the law, keeping every aspect of the law in our place, and his passive obedience being those areas where he laid himself down
and
suffered on our behalf. Through the passion, yeah.
With those descriptions, something along the lines of Romans 5, you know, where Paul describes his one act of obedience, of righteousness. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at the entire life of Christ cumulatively, his perfect obedience, which is obedience even through suffering, mm-hmm. and taking on all of the suffering that he was to endure, all of which came from the hand of God. Now, where we actually bring down the dividing line as to when it became redemptive, I think it's all redemptive because that made him the spotless Lamb of God for us throughout.
Yeah, I don't use the terms passive and active obedience because I feel like what you just described, it is all active. For him to say, I lay down my life and I take my life up again, that's all active as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
I don't believe that there was ever a passive obedience to the will of God.
He was actively suffering.
He was actively suffering on purpose for his people, that it was all active. So yes, he actively kept the law, actively was spotless, and actively died on our behalf, and actively redeemed his people, is the way I have always viewed it.
Right.
And the distinction I was trying to make this morning, which I may have just clouded the issue by even bringing it up, but the issue I was trying to make was that the Mel Gibson movie, being very Romish, put so much emphasis on the beating as the redemptive place that the cross became quite secondary in the movie. He was on the cross for a little while, and then we went right to the grave, and then he got up naked, and that was pretty much it.
And I'm even wondering if looking at his victimization as primarily redemptive, and when he's on the cross, it's kind of like, that's just sort of the final oomph of what he's going through, and down comes this teardrop from heaven, feeling sorry for the whole pathetic scene.
Exactly. You're exactly right. And that is a horrible misunderstanding of what really happened. The beatings that he took led to the cross, but the cross is where redemption took place. And to steer our focus away from Calvary to anything else, whether that's something that happened before the cross or whether it's something that happens after the cross. Frequently people do that. Yes, the cross took place, but it only made salvation available. And now after the cross, more stuff has to happen, whether that's you choose or you decide or you add to the cross. Mel Gibson would like to add the suffering of Christ leading to the cross. Actually, he wants to raise it up above the cross because then physical human suffering becomes the meritorious act that gets God's attention. And I say no, not at all.
I think certainly the most crystallized culmination that's given to us in the New Testament of that most effective point of Christ's suffering is on the cross. Mm-hmm. As Paul argues in Galatians, curses everyone who hangs on the tree.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that hanging on the tree was where our justification was secured.
That's where it all took place.
And also that Jeff recited from Peter in 1 Peter 2. The wounding, all of that, our healing came through as he was bearing our sins in his body on the tree, on the cross. So certainly I think that's where our emphasis should be as well, since that's where God's word puts it.
In other words, what I just said for the last 20 minutes, he summed up perfectly in about a minute there. That was exactly where we were going. Now, have we confused anybody in the course of that discussion?
Sure.
Is there...
But I thoroughly appreciate you trying to work through and think through these things with us, because we all need to do that. That's what...
Oh, absolutely.
Doing theology and doing the Bible.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And that's why we have this kind of format of question and answer and people being able to discuss, is that that's the best way for us all to come to a meeting of the minds. I mean, if we're going to be joined by sound doctrine, we got to be able to talk through the doctrine to the point where we all understand it, except Scott. And so that's...
So,
it's real easy. It's actually real easy. Despite all that,
theology,
it's real easy. Theology 101.
I just keep going back.
It's actually really, really easy, which is God is sovereign. He poured out his wrath at Calvary. That's where redemption happened.
Now, I understand the whole concept you guys are talking about, and I was enlightened by the debate.
Is that on tape?
Yes. That's why you get to be in the front row. I'm back in Luke. Luke 23. Verse 14, you've brought this man unto me as one that perverts the people, and behold, I, having examined him before you, have found no fault in this man, touching those things whereof you accuse him. No, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him. I will therefore chastise him and release him. That's where we got off. That's where we took the left turn into that chastisement and the meaning and purpose of it. Verse 17, for of necessity he must release one of them at the feast. This is what I told you about. At Passover every year, Pilate would release a prisoner to them. And so he thought that satisfied it. He said, okay, then I'll release him. Every year at Passover, I release somebody, I release Jesus. And Peter's interpretation of that in Acts 3:13 was that Pilate really did want to release him, really wanted to let him go. He did not want to have this on his hands. Verse 18. Verse 18 makes a sudden leap here because Luke is synopsizing. And we're going to go read the other gospel accounts of this whole section because they all fill in different details. But suddenly there's this leap where it sounds like he's just talking to the leaders, and then suddenly there's a crowd introduced in verse 18. What you don't know, and that the others fill in, is that he stands before the whole crowd of the Jews and offers them, do you want Jesus, or would you rather have Barabbas, a murderer, a seditionist? Would you rather have him, or would you rather have Jesus, who, as far as we can tell, has done nothing wrong? But the priests and the Pharisees have been milling through the crowd, threatening people, and saying, when he asks who you want, say, give us Barabbas, and tell him, crucify Jesus. And of course, they wield, again, so much political power over the people, all these politics running rampant, that they, for fear, end up saying, give us Barabbas and kill Jesus. Luke leaps over all that information, goes right to verse 18 and says, and they cried out all at once. Well, there's no explanation for why they would all cry out like that unless you have all those other details filled in. They cry out all at once, saying, away with this man, and release unto us Barabbas, who for a certain sedition made in the city, and for murder, was cast into prison. Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, see, even Luke saw it as Pilate really wanting this off his hands. Pilate, willing to release Jesus, spoke again to them, but they cried, saying, crucify him, crucify him. I believe it's John's account that will tell you that remarkably, these people who had been under the thumb of Rome, who had no great love for Rome, are going to end up talking about their love for Caesar. They're going to end up speaking against Christ and saying, Caesar's our king. And they're going to end up swearing allegiance to Rome. That's how bizarre this is going to get. Because nothing unites people faster than a common enemy. Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, spoke to them. They cried, saying, crucify him, crucify him. Don't just read past those words without putting flesh and blood on it. Again, you have a mob of people. Jerusalem is crammed full of people who are all there for the Passover from different areas and different dialects and different backgrounds, but all Jewish, and they're all gathered there. Now you've got all the... Just think about the dirt and the dust and the mob and the people crying out, crucify him, the Son of God. who's done nothing wrong, who's done nothing but good among them, these people become so wrapped up in the mob mentality that they all start crying for the crucifixion of Christ. There's depravity en masse. And he said unto them the third time, why? What evil has he done? I have found no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. This is always his plan. Look, I just intend to chastise him and let him go. And these people continue to insist. Verse 23, and they were instant with loud voices, requiring that he might be crucified. And the voices of them and of the chief priests, who were down there in the mob telling them what to say, prevailed. And Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. You can see that Pilate was not, despite the way he's been portrayed in films for all these years, he was not up there announcing the death of Christ in a dictatorial way. You can see three times telling these people, look, I don't intend to do, look, I plan to let him, I'll scourge him and let him go. Here, I'll even put him up against a murderer. Who do you want? You can see him finally just going, okay, you can't resist what all these people want. Remember, these were the same people who were willing to bare their necks and say, chop it off if you won't do it our way. He knows the stubbornness of these people. And once the Jews get this idea in their head, this is the way we want it, and Matthew's account, he's going to end up talking about the responsibility for this. And they are going to say, let his blood be on us and on our children. That's just dark. That's just sinister. Let the responsibility of him be on us and on our children. By the way, that was one of the lines that had to be cut out of the Passion of the Christ that was in the original script, apparently, that when the Jewish leaders saw it, said, no, 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 no. And so in order to rewrite history and make it more approachable by more masses of people with $7 in their hands, we're willing to just scratch out parts of the Bible, yeah. Say, no, 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 we're not going to have that. But we will have stuff like Pilate's wife coming out with clean white towels that look like they just came from Holiday Inn. And hand these to Mary, and Mary will be out there where the beating took place, wiping up the blood. Or the woman who came out while Jesus was walking toward the cross, and he put his face in the towel and took it off and got a perfect imprint on it that looked remarkably like the Shroud of Turin. And she even turned it toward the camera for us. I mean, it was... Okay, so that stuff that's not in the Bible, we'll include that, but stuff that really is in the Bible, like his blood be on us and on our children, no. That's too anti-Jewish. We'll just eliminate that stuff. But the truth is, these people, and this is why I emphasize it, the truth is these people were so engaged in their flesh and their mob mentality and their overwhelming hatred for the Son of God that they were willing to take the personal responsibility and put the responsibility on their children. By the way, did that go well for them? 70 A.D., knock down the temple. The number of crucifixions outside the wall of Jerusalem that day is supposedly one of the largest mass crucifixions in the history of the Roman Empire. Bodies of Jews crucified outside the walls of Jerusalem in 70 AD. I think God heard them. Let his blood be on us and on our children. That's what happened. So you got to be careful when you say stuff because God's listening. God's paying attention. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. He released unto them him that for sedition and for murder was cast into prison. So they got Barabbas, whom they had desired, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. And so he was going to be crucified. Turn to Matthew real quick. I'm going to fill in a couple blanks. Matthew 27. Matthew fills in a little detail here about Judas that Luke doesn't bring up. So we need to finish the narrative of what became of Judas. Chapter 27, starting at verse 1, when morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away to deliver him unto Pontius Pilate, the governor. Now, Matthew is going to tell us about the death of Judas and about them bringing Jesus to Pilate, and doesn't mention anything about Herod. But he does tell us about Judas, starting in verse 3. Then Judas, when he had betrayed him, or which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself, and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? You go see to it. And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple, and he departed, and he went and hanged himself. And the chief priests took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful for us to put the money in the treasury because it is the price of blood. Isn't it remarkable that these guys now are discussing what's lawful? What a strange moment for them to say, oh, that wouldn't be lawful. Now that whole paying money to have a guy betrayed so that we can have him trumped up on charges and killed, we're okay with that.
There's a reason that it is blood money.
Yeah, there is a reason it is blood money. They paid that money to get his blood. It's blood money. Oh yeah, straining out gnats, swallowing camels. They took counsel and they bought with that money a potter's field to bury strangers in. Wherefore, to this day it is called the field of blood. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him that was valued, whom they of the children of Israel did value, and they gave them for a potter's field, as the Lord appointed me. What's a potter's field? You know, that's Hebrew language that we're not as familiar with. There was a lot of pottery in Israel. One of the ways that archaeologists have been able to trace the journeys of the Israelites for their 40 years through the wilderness, through the desert, one of the ways they were able to trace that movement was by the broken pottery that's strewn through the desert, because they were constantly making and breaking pottery. If it broke, you'd make more, you'd just leave it behind. So language of potsherds is very common in the Bible, which is broken pieces of pottery. Job, when he was lancing his boils and sores, it says he was scraping with a potsherd, broken pieces of pottery. Well, that language of pottery is also the language that God chooses to use when speaking of human beings. Takes Jeremiah to the potter's house and says, what do you see? He says, well, I see a potter working a work on the wheel. And God says, that's right. I'm like the potter and you're like the vessels. In fact, he says, Israel is like the vessel on the wheel and I can do with it whatever I want. The same way, he says, look at the way that the potter, if the pot is marred in his hand, can either remake it or throw it away. It's up to the potter to do what he wants with the pottery. And so he likens Israel to pottery. And then that same imagery is picked up in Romans 9. And Paul starts talking about the same idea. Potter, God is the potter. Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why have you made me thus? Doesn't the potter have power over the clay of one lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor? That language of pottery runs rampant through the Bible, and God uses it as the language to describe human beings. But not just human beings, broken human beings, broken pottery. So the price, the cost that was paid, the blood money that was paid to betray Jesus, ended up buying a field full of broken pots. Do I have to make the connection? The price of Christ's death ended up redeeming a field full of broken pots. That'd be you and me, us. God continues to teach the same lesson over and over, that even the money that was spent to betray him, that was meant by evil people for evil deeds, ended up redeeming a field of broken pots, like us. So that same redemptive story keeps getting told over and over. In Israel, when you had all your broken pottery, you couldn't just have it laying around the house. In every city, there was a designated area, a junkyard, where you would throw your broken pottery. And they needed a new potter's field where you could throw broken pottery. So they paid those pieces of silver to buy a new field the broken pots could go into. And the price of Christ redeemed a potter's field full of me and Mike and Tom, people like that. Isn't that great little redemptive information built into the story over and over again? Meanwhile, poor Judas, he was used by Satan. Satan entered into him at the Last Supper. Jesus said, what you're doing, do quickly. Inspired by Satan, he went out and betrayed him. And then the indication is that Satan left him alone. And when he came to himself, he recognized what he'd done. He'd betrayed innocent blood. He had betrayed Jesus. There have been a lot of theories through the years as to why Judas would have done that. There's one theory that Judas thought maybe if Jesus was pressed to the wall, he'd finally fight. He'd finally rise up, throw off the yoke of Rome, and establish the kingdom. And Judas really wanted to see Jesus fight. But what we know for sure is that, inspired by Satan, he went and did exactly what God preordained would be done. Which means that Satan and Judas and the Jews and the Gentiles and Pontius Pilate and King Herod all did precisely and exactly what God foreordained to be done.
Puppets.
Yes, puppets and pawns. That's all they were, I tell you, you Calvinists.
I hear that a lot now.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. But you know, okay, as long as you brought that up, I'm going to say this, we're going to call it a morning. I know I've kept it too late. Yes, everybody in the Bible and everybody in life and everybody on the planet has somebody pulling their strings. The lesson of Judas ought to be a big lesson for us. Was Judas free to do whatever he wanted? No, he was Satan's puppet. Are we somebody's puppet? Yeah, God's puppet. Yeah, God is pulling my strings, and I'm real happy for it, because the notion that if God doesn't pull your strings, you're a free agent doesn't exist. Either God's pulling your strings, or as we saw in Judas' case, Satan's pulling your strings. You're either a child of wrath, or you're a redeemed child. You are either always doing your father the devil's will, or you're doing your father God's will. But there's no neutral ground, there's no gray area. Somebody's pulling your strings. And the next time somebody says, well, you're nothing but a puppet, say, yes, thank God, I am his puppet. Because the other choice is to end up like Judas and get played like a puppet by the devil, who ended up hanging himself over it. That's the other choice. And there's no gray area. There's no free agents running around deciding of their own will what they're going to do. You're going to serve somebody. And thank God if you're serving God. What are you reading, Jeff?
What you were talking about in Romans.
Say it. I knew that was where you were going. I knew it. Read it.
Now, Paul said, do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as slaves for obedience, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin resulting in death, or of obedience resulting in righteousness. But thanks be to God that though you were slaves of sin, you became obedient from the heart, that form of teaching to which you were committed, and have been freed from sin. And having been freed from sin, you became slaves of righteousness.
So. You're a slave either way. You're a slave of sin or you're a slave of righteousness, but you're a slave. Let's replace the word slave. You're a puppet to somebody. You're a puppet of your flesh and sin, or you're a puppet of righteousness. But either way, you're a puppet. Get used to it. And if you don't end up in Judas' situation, thank God. That was just mercy and grace, because nobody deserves any better. All right, that was a lot of information this morning. Thank you for your patience. But I had to start out by talking about the new audio book. Okay.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.